You are holding a medical referral, and there is just this glaring miscommunication happening right on the page.
Oh, yeah, I know exactly what you mean.
Right, like on one line, your doctor has ordered a PFT, but then when you look at the actual appointment scheduled by the clinic, it says you are going in for spirometry.
Which is incredibly common, yeah.
Which happens all the time. And if you follow clinical practices or just pay close attention to, healthcare administration, people often frame this spirometry versus PFT thing as this heavyweight fight between two completely competing tests.
Like they're rivals or something.
Exactly. But framing it as a rivalry is just a massive false dichotomy. So, welcome to the deep dive. Our mission today is to untangle this acronym soup.
It's definitely a soup.
It really is. And whether you are a clinical professional trying to optimize your practice workflow or just someone trying to decode your own health records, we are going to extract the exact differences here. We're breaking down the physical science of how these tests actually work.
And the incredible technology that makes them possible, right?
Sure.
Dispelling that rivalry right at the top is so crucial. Choosing the right respiratory test is, I mean, it's never about one being inherently superior to the other.
Right, it's not a competition.
No, not at all. It entirely depends on the specific clinical question the physician is trying to answer, and, well, the physical environment where that question is being asked.
Okay, so let's establish our definitions first so we can actually understand the mechanics at play here. The classic square and rectangle analogy seems to apply perfectly.
Oh, for sure.
Like a PFT or pulmonary function testing is not a single test at all. It's a broad family category.
Yeah, it's really an umbrella term, one that encompasses multiple, completely different diagnostic procedures.
And spirometry is just one specific tool underneath that umbrella. So basically, every spirometry test is a PFT, but not every PFT is spirometry.
That is the absolute core of it. Spirometry is just the most common fundamental pulmonary function test we have.
But I have to push back a little on the medical industry's naming habits here. Because, I mean, if a doctor orders a PFT, but the clinic only has the hardware to perform basic spirometry, isn't that incredibly misleading to the patient?
Well, they can be, yeah.
Like, if I order a vehicle, I really need to know if you are sending me a binocle or a freight train. Why is the clinical terminology so loose?
It's a fair question. It really comes down to the stark realities of primary care infrastructure versus, specialty clinics. In a general family practice, spirometry is often the literally only pulmonary testing equipment they own.
Oh, really?
Yeah, it is their frontline tool. So when a general practitioner says, let's run a PFT, what they actually mean is, let's check your basic lung function with the only tool we have in the building.
Ah, okay.
The broad category name just gets conflated with the most frequently used tool purely out of, well, operational shorthand.
Oh, I see. It's like asking someone to pass you a Kleenex when you really just mean a generic facial tissue.
Exactly.
The brand becomes the action.
Right. It's a linguistic shortcut. But that shortcut becomes a pretty serious problem when we look at the actual physics of what these different tests measure.
Right, so since spirometry is the frontline defense, we should probably transition into the mechanics of what it physically measures inside the body.
Good idea. So spirometry is strictly an evaluation of airflow and forced lung volume. It is designed to capture how much air a person can move and, critically, the velocity of that air.
And there are two key metrics driving this data, right? You have FEV1, which is the amount of air exhaled in the very first second of a forced blow.
Yes.
And then you have FVC, which is the total amount of air forcefully exhaled after taking the deepest breath possible.
You got it. And the physical execution of this, I mean, it is intense for the patient. They have to take an absolute maximum inhalation, seal their lips tightly around the mouthpiece, and blast the air out as hard and as fast as humanly possible.
Wow, that sounds exhausting.
It is. And the current standards, which are established by the American Thoracic Society and the European Respiratory Society, they are incredibly strict. They demand at least three acceptable, highly reproducible measurements per testing set.
Wait, why put a patient through that exhaustion three separate times if you already got a good measurement on the first try?
Well, because a single effort can be entirely misleading.
Oh, like a fluke.
Exactly. The
Yeah.
patient might have coughed slightly, or maybe they hesitated for a fraction of a second, or they just failed to inhale to their absolute true maximum.
Right, that makes sense.
So the clinical guidelines require those three reproducible blows just to prove that the data represents the patient's genuine physiological baseline rather than, just a single fluke effort.
Okay, so what they are ultimately looking for is that FEV1 FVC ratio. And I was conceptualizing this ratio like a major highway system.
I like that.
Right. So the FVC is the total number of cars on the road, the absolute volume of air, and the FEV1 represents how fast those cars can pass through a toll booth in 1 second.
Yes, exactly.
So if you have a normal amount of cars, but they are just crawling past the toll booth at a fraction of the normal speed, well, you have a severe traffic jam. And in the human lung, that traffic jam translates to an airflow obstruction.
That analogy highlights the mechanism perfectly. Because when a patient has an obstructive disease like asthma or a chronic condition like COPD, the physical airways narrow or even collapse under the pressure of that forced exhalation.
Right, the pipes get smaller.
Exactly. The total volume of air the cars, in your analogy, might eventually get out, but the velocity is heavily compromised. In fact, clinical guidance states that the gold standard for confirming a COPD diagnosis actually relies on post-bronchodilator spirometry.
Okay, meaning you test them, then you give the medication to open up the airways, and then you test them again.
Yes. And if their FEV1 FVC ratio remains below 0.7 even after taking the medication, well, it confirms an irreversible obstruction.
Got it. But this actually introduces a massive question I had about the limitations of spirometry, because a low FVC means a low total volume of air is coming out of the body. So if the FVC measures the total air exiting the lungs and that number is abnormally low, why isn't that just definitive proof that the person's lungs are physically restricted or shrunken in size?
This is where we really have to look at the physical limitations of the lung itself. Your lungs are actually never completely empty.
Never.
Never. Even when you push out every last ounce of breath you possibly can, there is always a significant volume of air left behind just to keep the alveoli, the tiny air sacs, from collapsing entirely.
Oh, wow. I didn't realize that.
Yeah, and we call that the residual volume.
Okay, so spirometry is entirely blind to the air left parked in the garage, so to speak. It only sees the air actively driving on the highway.
You've hit the nail on the head. A low FVC might mean the physical capacity of the lung is restricted, sure, but it could also mean the patient has such severe airway obstruction that the air is just trapped inside the lung and simply can't be forced out fast enough during the test.
So it's ambiguous?
Very. Spirometry simply cannot distinguish between true physical restriction and severe air trapping.
And that limitation, I mean, that is exactly why the broader pulmonary function tests exist in the first place. Spirometry hits a diagnostic wall, it can't confirm restriction, and it tells us absolutely nothing about gas transfer.
Right, which is when we have to zoom out to the full PFT lab. Stepping into a full PFT lab means moving beyond basic airflow mechanics entirely. You are introducing tests to measure total lung capacity, residual volume, and DLCO.
And DLCO stands for diffusing capacity of the lungs for carbon monoxide, right?
Yes, exactly.
DLCO sounds incredibly complex. How does that physically work?
It measures cellular exchange.
Yeah.
You can have a completely clear airway with no obstruction whatsoever, but if the oxygen isn't physically crossing that incredibly thin barrier from the alveoli into your bloodstream, you are going to experience severe shortness of breath.
Right. The air is there, but it's not getting into the body.
Precisely. So during a DLCO test, the patient actually inhales a tiny safe amount of carbon monoxide mixed with a tracer gas.
Because carbon monoxide binds to hemoglobin much faster than oxygen, right?
Extremely fast. So by measuring what the patient exhales 10 seconds later, the machine calculates exactly how much of that gas crossed the alveolar capillary membrane into the blood.
That is wild.
It is. It gives the physician a highly precise picture of the lung's actual functioning surface area.
Okay, then we have body plethysmography. And honestly, this sounds like an isolation chamber, like a patient steps into an enclosed, airtight box that looks a lot like an old telephone booth.
It really does look like a phone booth.
So how does sitting in a sealed box actually tell a doctor how much air is trapped inside a human chest?
It relies entirely on Boyle's law from physics. That law dictates that pressure and volume are inversely proportional at a constant temperature. So while the patient is inside the sealed cabin, they breathe through a mouthpiece.
Okay.
Then a shutter briefly blocks the airflow, and the patient makes a gentle panting motion against that closed shutter.
So their chest expands and contracts, but no air is actually moving in or out of their mouth.
Right. When your chest expands against the closed shutter, the pressure inside their lungs drops. But because they are expanding their chest volume inside a perfectly sealed, rigid box, the pressure inside the box simultaneously rises.
Oh, I see.
The computer then measures the microscopic pressure changes inside the cabin to calculate the exact volume of air residing in the patient's thorax. is a brilliant, highly precise application of basic physics.
It is brilliant, but it also raises a massive question regarding clinical strategy, I think. Because if a full PFT suite gives us all of this incredible high-definition data-gas exchange, trapped air, cellular diffusion, why do we even bother with basic spirometry at all?
I know. It seems counterintuitive.
Right. Like, why risk missing something? Shouldn't we just put everyone in the telephone booth to be completely safe?
That sounds ideal in theory, definitely. But it collides instantly with the reality of healthcare economics and clinical efficiency. Implementing full plethysmography and diffusion testing requires massive capital investment.
Oh, the machines are expensive.
Very. The equipment is huge. It requires dedicated climate-controlled laboratory space. And it demands highly specialized respiratory technicians just to operate it.
So it's a huge bottleneck.
A massive one.
Mm.
Furthermore, for the vast majority of patients, say someone with mild intermittent asthma, or an employee getting an annual occupational health screening for a dusty workplace, their clinical question is strictly related to airflow.
They don't need all the cellular data.
Right. Putting a mild asthmatic through a 45-minute plethysmography session is, well, it's an egregious waste of resources. Spirometry remains the ultimate frontline tool because it answers the most common respiratory questions with incredible speed and minimal cost.
You only escalate to the full PFT lab when the basic spirometry data fails to explain the patient's symptoms.
Exactly.
So you match the diagnostic tool to the complexity of the problem. That makes perfect sense. But looking closely at how these tests are executed, there is a variable that seems, I don't know, dangerously unpredictable to me, the human element.
Oh, the human element is the single most disruptive variable in pulmonary diagnostics.
Yep.
Without a doubt.
Because if you cough prematurely, or if your lips don't form a perfect seal around the mouthpiece, or if you simply lack the willpower to push through the physical discomfort of a maximum exhalation, the entire data set is basically ruined.
Exactly.
It sounds like the clinician isn't just a technician operating a machine. They are essentially acting as an aggressive sports coach trying to extract peak athletic performance out of the patient.
That is the perfect way to describe it. Go to any pulmonary lab and you will literally hear respiratory therapists actively shouting, blow, 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 push, keep going.
Really? Just yelling?
Yes. They have to act as coaches because submaximal effort masquerades as disease. If you don't blow hard enough, the machine might output a curve that looks completely identical to severe lung restriction.
Wow. And the hardware has to be as perfectly tuned as the coaching, right? The AITSR standard requires daily calibration checks using a specific 3-liter calibration syringe.
Yeah.
And the accuracy margin is shockingly tight. It has to be accurate to within plus or minus 0.015 liters or just 0.5% of the full scale.
The tolerances are that tight because the downstream consequences are massive. A minor drift in the sensor's calibration combined with, say, a mediocre effort from the patient can lead directly to a false diagnosis of chronic lung disease.
Which means a lifetime of unnecessary medication.
Exactly. Which is terrible for the patient.
So let's look at how that data actually gets interpreted by the doctors, because the underlying math recently underwent a massive evolution. The 2022 ERSAT's interpretive framework aggressively moved the industry away from simple, fixed cutoffs.
Yes, it was a huge shift.
Instead, they emphasized predicted values, reference equations, lower limits of normal, and Z-scores based on massive population studies. And I understand what an average is, but how does a Z-score actually function in this context? And why are those old flat cutoffs considered dangerous now?
Well, the problem with a flat cutoff is that it ignores the enormous natural variation in human physiology. A Z-score is a statistical metric that tells the physician precisely how many standard deviations a patient's result sits away from the exact median of a healthy population.
Okay, so it's a lot more specific.
Hyper-specific.
Yeah.
It compares the patient only to healthy individuals of the exact same age, height, biological sex, and ethnicity.
So you are essentially grading the patient on a highly customized curve.
Yes, and that customized curve is what prevents massive misdiagnoses. Because if you use a rigid flat cutoff, you might look at the data of an 80-year-old woman and diagnose her with severe lung disease simply because her numbers are lower than a 40-year-old's.
Even though her lungs might be perfectly healthy for an 80-year-old.
Exactly. And on the flip side, a 20-year-old elite athlete might hit the flat cutoff and be told they're totally fine, even though a Z-score would reveal their lung function has dropped dangerously low for their specific demographic.
Wow, that makes so much sense.
The adoption of Z-scores really forces critical statistical thinking into the diagnostic process.
But that brings up a massive logistical challenge, doesn't it? You have rigorous standards, complex physical maneuvers, strict calibration rules, and deep statistical math. How do clinics practically implement this? A busy family doctor can't install a massive plethysmography booth, but they still need high-quality data.
This is where biomedical engineering has really stepped up to bridge the gap. We can look at companies like Bomibe, for example, which have designed specific tiers of spirometry equipment to match the unique environments of different clinics.
It's like having different vehicles for different terrain. Like you mentioned earlier, they have the Minispur.
Right.
The documentation highlights that it's a PC-based handheld unit that features an embedded temperature sensor for BTPS conversion. But let's pause right there. What is BTPS conversion, and why does the machine need a temperature sensor to measure airflow?
It's fascinating, actually. BTPS stands for body temperature and pressure, saturated. So when air is inside your lungs, it is sitting at a warm 37 degrees Celsius and is fully saturated with water vapor.
Okay.
But when you forcefully exhale that air into a spirometer, it enters a room that is significantly cooler and drier.
Oh, and physical laws dictate that when a gas cools down, it physically shrinks in volume.
Precisely. If the machine simply measures the volume of the cold air passing through the sensor, it will artificially underestimate the size of the patient's lung capacity.
Because the air shrank.
Right. So the embedded temperature sensor in a device like the Minispur actively measures the room temperature and dynamically calculates the exact volume that air occupied while it was still hot and expanded inside the patient's body.
That is an incredible level of automatic calculation for just a handheld device.
It really is. It removes a massive layer of manual math from the clinician's workflow.
Then you scale up to something like the Spirobank 2 Basic. This one is fully portable with a long-life rechargeable battery. I can easily see how that fits a fast-paced sports medicine clinic where doctors are moving constantly between exam rooms.
And they need the hardware to travel in their pocket, exactly. It brings the diagnostic capability directly to the point of care rather than forcing the clinic to dedicate a specific room purely for testing.
And if a clinic needs deep digital integration, BoMyMed offers the Spirobank 2 Smart. This brings in tablet and mobile app support, optional oximetry, and the ability to share data via HL7 standards. I've heard of HL7, but what does it actually do here?
HL7 is basically the global software standard that allows different healthcare systems to communicate securely.
Ah, go.
A device utilizing HL7 means the spirometry data flows instantaneously from the handheld unit directly into the hospital's central electronic medical record. There is no manual data entry, which, you know, eliminates transcription errors entirely.
Which is huge for patient safety. Now, the highest tier they offer is the Spirolab, which is a full desktop workstation. It features a large touchscreen, a built-in printer, and something called pediatric incentive animations.
Oh, those are amazing.
I find this absolutely fascinating because it connects directly back to the human element we discussed earlier. Like, how do you get a perfect physical effort out of a terrified four-year-old who has no idea what a forced vital capacity maneuver is?
Well, you don't ask them to perform a medical maneuver. You turn it into a game.
So you put an animation of a birthday cake on the screen and tell them they have to blow hard enough to extinguish all the candles.
Exactly. Or you show them an animation of a wolf blowing down the three little pigs' houses. The harder and longer they exhale, the further the animation progresses.
That's so smart.
A pediatric patient cannot comprehend the instruction to exhale for a minimum of 3 seconds, but they absolutely understand the instruction to keep blowing until the brick house falls down.
Of course they do.
Incorporating that psychology into the technology is really how you achieve diagnostic accuracy with incredibly difficult patient demographics.
So what is the ultimate takeaway for you listening to this right now? We have mapped out a totally fascinating landscape today. We completely dismantled the idea that spirometry and PFTs are competing forces, realizing instead that spirometry is simply the sharpest, most frequently used tool in a much larger diagnostic toolkit.
Yeah. And we saw how understanding simple physics, like the difference between moving air and parked air, dictates whether a doctor can use a quick handheld test or needs to refer a patient to a complex plethysmography chamber.
Exactly. We explored the deep science of gas transfer and pressure changes, and we uncovered how critical the human element is to securing accurate data. Companies like BOMEM aren't just building plastic tubes. They are engineering sophisticated devices that automatically calculate thermal shrinkage and use interactive psychology to guide patients toward perfect results.
Because the technology has to exist to support the clinical reality, from the smallest family practice to the most advanced diagnostic laboratory.
And the relevance here is highly practical. If you ever find yourself sitting in a clinic, wrapping your lips around a plastic mouthpiece, you now know exactly why the technician is shouting at you like a drill sergeant.
Oh yeah, they aren't just being mean.
Right. You understand the incredible precision required by the hardware. And if your primary care doctor refers you to a specialty lab to check your residual volume or gas transfer, you know exactly what is happening inside your cellular biology to warrant that referral.
I do want to leave you with one final thought to ponder. Looking back at our discussion on the 2022 interpretive framework and those complex Z-scores, we established that modern respiratory medicine relies heavily on reference equations built from the expected ranges of healthy populations.
Right.
But this creates a fascinating, almost philosophical challenge for the future of medicine. If our baseline for what constitutes a healthy lung is inherently tied to the population average, well, how might rapidly changing global environments, like increasing exposure to microplastics, unprecedented urban air pollution, or persistent wildfire smoke, eventually force the medical community to entirely redefine what a normal human lung looks like in the data?
Wow.
If the baseline of humanity's environment shifts, the mathematical definition of health might be forced to shift right along with it.
So if the underlying reality changes, the curve has to change with it. That is a massive concept to chew on. But until that curve shifts, the next time someone tries to hype up the great medical showdown of spirometry versus PFT, you can confidently tell them to call off the fight. They're on the exact same team. Thanks for joining us on this deep dive. We will catch you next time.